All right, welcome everyone. So today we're gonna have Dewey from Maryland. I think he's now a grad fellow at KITP, telling us about the Honeycomb for Kate code. Dewey, it's yours.
Yeah, so thank you, Chong, for the introduction. It's my honor to be invited here and then talk to people. So today I'm going to talk about the phase diagram of the Honeycomb Flowcat code. And I think if people have questions during my talk, then they can interrupt me and ask questions, right? Yeah, thank you.
Yes.
That's good.
Yeah.
And before I begin, I want to express my special thanks to Matthew Fisher, Ali Lavasani, and Zhong Yong Li, wonderful people that I met at KTP. They contribute a lot to this work, and without them, I cannot finish this one. So this is the outline of my talk. First and foremost, I will introduce you to the Flowcat code, which was invented, I think, a year ago. And then I will tell you why is it important and why is it relevant. Then I will show you the critical property of the Flowcat to non-Flowcat phase transition. And then based on that knowledge, I will build up a phase diagram interpolating between the Flowcat code and the toric code. And then I will conclude my talk with an open question that I hope will stimulate further collaboration with people at Perimeter. So even though I mentioned some code in my title, I will actually take a more condensed matter point of view to this problem. And in condensed matter, we are usually interested in the immersion behavior when we have a large number of items or molecules gathering together. And the reason is this is immersion behavior because this is somewhat robust against some microscopic variation. And then we all know some very famous example of condensed matter phases, which is the metal insulator phase or the topological phase, and then there are many other condensed matter phases. And right, until recently, we have another platform, which is the quantum circuit. So for the quantum circuit, you can do various things with it. You can apply a gate, which is equivalent to let the system evolve under Hamiltonian. Or you can also measure the qubit, or you can also measure multiple qubit. And this measurement is the distinction, I think, between the quantum circuit and the ordinary solid state systems. So what is actually measurement? Let's say we start with a wave function psi, and then under measurement, this wave function psi will collapse into one of the eigen wave function of the operator M with probability given by the overlap of the wave functions. And then, so I used to think that quantum circuit is only for quantum information and to implement quantum algorithms. But until I arrived at KTP, then I realized that this quantum circuit can also exhibit many immersion behavior, which defy a new way to categorize phases of matter, which are called measurement-induced phases. And these measurement-induced phases are just as rich as the condensed matter phases, if not even richer. For example, if we have metal insulator transition in the condensed matter phases, then in the measurement-induced phase, we have a transition between the volume law and the area law where we increase the measurement rate. This is the famous work done at KTP by Yang Dong Li, Chen, and Fisher. And for the topological phases, we can also have the same thing for the in the quantum circuit just by applying a specific measurement here. For example, in this work done at Maryland, we can induce the non-trivial topology to the quantum circuit by applying the IZX measurement operators. And it showed that this SPT phase is not just a singular behavior, but it's actually robust up to some Z noise and then some unitary noise. So the thing that I'm going to show you today in the language of condensed matter is the Pymore flow cap topological order. So let me just break down the name of it. So Pymore flow cap means that you will see some period doubling. And then topological order means that you will see this period doubling not in some local order parameter, but in a non-local order parameter. So some people call this time crystal, but because the order parameter we are looking at here is the non-local one. So I would like to categorize this behavior as a flow cap topology rather than time crystal. So before actually diving in the model, I want to make a quick remark about the formalism. Because so here the system I'm going to study is a quantum circuit with only measurement. In that case, we can only describe a many-body wave function by a collection of certain commuting operators. So for example, here, if we have a wave function of n qubit, then we can equivalently describe this n qubit wave function by n operators, such that these operators commute with each other. And then the wave function psi is an eigenfunction of any operator Si with eigenvalue plus one. So if you want to think about the eigenvalue minus one, or let's say I or minus I, you can always absorb that phase into the definition of S. So here I only care about S that have eigenvalue plus one corresponding to the wave function sign. And then such a collection of operators is called the stabilizer group. And what I'm going to do is I will study how the stabilizer group evolve under the measurement schedule. So now with that, formalism clear, let me go into the detail model. So the model I'm going to use is based on the Hastings and Honeycomb code. This code consists of a hexagonal lattice, and we have a qubit on every lattice side. And then for each hexagon, we can color it by three color, either red, blue or green, so that true neighbor bracket doesn't share the same color. And the actual measurement schedule is that in each round, we will measure all the links that connect true bracket of the same color. For example, here I have an explicit measurement schedule. We'll start with measuring all the red links, and then all the blue links, and then all the green links. And then we will come back with all the red links again. So that constitutes one cycle of the code. So let's see how the stabilizer group evolve under this scheme. So let's see, after the first red round, we have three red links in the stabilizer group per each bracket. And now when we move to the blue round, because we are measuring the blue links here, so these blue links will also enter the stabilizer group. But then you will see that because these red links, they anti-commute with the blue links. So these sick links, they cannot coexist in the stabilizer group because they will violate this commutation condition. But instead, we will see that the product of three red links, they commute with all the blue links. So now your stabilizer group will be updated to three blue links. And then a bracket operator make up the product of all the red links and all the blue links. And you can repeat the process over and over again. So what we have in the steady state is that after each measurement round, you will have in the stabilizer group on the bracket operator and on the links operator having the same color. So at this point, does anyone have questions?
Maybe just to clarify, just make sure I didn't.
Oh, yes, please.
remember anything wrong. So when you talk about a link, is the operator based, the KitHive Honeycomb operator? What was the measurement basis again, basically?
This is the measurement base. Yeah, so when I talk about link sign, I mean like I will measure a link operator here. For example, this this thread link, I will measure the x on one end and x on one end. So I measure the xx operator. And here I measure the yy operator, zz operators.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for asking. So why this flow cat code important? So here is an example after a red route. And then you see that all the red links are measured. So if we just focus on one red link, like this one, we start with two qubits. So you will have a four-dimensional Hilbert space. But then after applying a ZZ measurement on this two qubit, then your wave function will collapse into a linear combination of either up, up, or down, down, because we are selecting a wave function with eigenvalue plus one. So the measurement here will collapse the four-dimensional Hilbert space to the two-dimensional Hilbert space. And you can consider this two-dimensional Hilbert space as an effective qubit.
Sorry, one quick question. Is this post-selection thing important for your later story, or is it more like a convenient thing?
So so post-selection is important. But actually, I think you are asking about either we are choosing the plus one eigenfunction, eigenvalue or minus one. So as I already mentioned, the plus one or minus one, we can reabsorb it into the definition of the operator inside the stabilizer group. So if we have a plus one, then the component of a stabilizer group will be ZZ. And if we have the minus one eigenfunction, then we can just change that operator into minus ZZ.
Okay.
But then, yeah, in this work, I will not care about the phase of the operator. So okay. I just assume that, all the measurement, we will select the plus one eigen.
I see. So you're not actually doing the post-selection.
Later on, I will show you, we still need to do some post-selection per each trajectories.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. So right now, if you consider each red link as an effective qubit, then you can connect them together. And then you immediately see that we realize a hexagonal super lattice here. And then we have an effective qubit on every green links here. So that's about the links measurement, the links operator. So what about plaquettes operator? If you look at this plaquette, so this one cut six links, and then if you project this plaquette operators onto the effective qubit, then you see that it acts at a product of six Z operator surrounding this plaquette, this super lattice plaquette. And then if you look at this plaquette operator, then this one cut three links. And also you can project this plaquette operator onto the effective Hilbert space. And then you see that it effectively acts as a product of three Y operator on the effective qubit. So right now, if you look at this super lattice, you see that it's exactly a toric chord on a hexagonal lattice with plaquette operator Z, 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 Z here, and psi operator Y, Y here. So this flow cat code, it can realize a topological order of toric chord without any many body measurement. So if you just step back and think of the toric chord, we actually need for a square toric chord, we need a at least a four qubit measurement, right? And then for this effective honeycomb lattice toric chord, we need a six qubit operator. But because but if you look at the actual measurement schedule here, we only have two body measurements. So this is one advantage of the flow cat code. And then, so it was that's the reason people invented it, because two-body measurement is always easier than many-body measurement. And then for some platform, like for example, the MasterNet platforms, then two-body measurement is the only thing people can do. But this flow gate code does not only just realize the topological order toric code, it can also correct some errors. So because what you have here is actually a sequence of non-commuting measurement. So people show that if you have some errors at some route, then in the next error, because we have the anti-commutation between different measurement, so that error might be destroyed, or I'll say fixed by the measurement of the next route. So this is just one wonderful thing about the flow gate code. And then if you just look at the quantum information aspect of the flow gate code, there are like a million more things to talk about. But in this talk, as I already mentioned, I will look at the flow gate code from more condensed-matter point of view. So on this super lattice, we can define two types of excitation. One type is the electric type excitation, which is a string that connects the super lattice cell, like this one. And the other type is the magnetic string, which travel along the edge of the super lattice cell. So let's see, if I start with an E string here, that again connects the super lattice cell, and then I involve the stabilizer group under the measurement schedule. So when I go from the red route to the blue route, you see this XZ, XY, XZ, XY, it will change into this one, Z, X, Y, X, Z, X, Y, X. And then if you trace along this operator, you will see that now it goes along the edge of the super lattice cell. So we effectively change an E string to an M string here. And then when you move from the blue round to the green round, you see the similar thing, like for this ZX change into XZ, YX change into XY, and so on. And then also when you trace along this operator, it now connects the super lattice cell. So we have another conversion from M to E, and so on. So this flow gate code will actually change the type of the excitation from E to M when we move from one color round to another color round. But the interesting thing here is that your cycle will consist of three colors. You start with the red links and end up with the red links. So from one red round to another red round, your stabilizer group will repeat itself. But then the excitation will change from E excitation to M excitation. So this is the interesting behavior of the flow gate code. So this specifically, that's the EM automorphism. And you can see clearly that it breaks the translational symmetry here. So this is the thing that I already prelude in the beginning. You have some period doubling manifest in some non-local order parameter. But then we still have a question that whether this behavior is just a specific behavior when we have a specific model, or is it an immersion behavior that is robust up to some microscopic variation? So that's the question I'm going to answer.
Can I ask a question?
Oh, yes, please.
So after one round, you say the E becomes M, but isn't the whole wave function now becoming a different wave function? Or am I missing something?
So it's not the whole wave function. So a way to think about it is that in your stabilizer group, you will have a bug operator, which is like the operator that you can define inside a bug. And then this string is actually, you can call it the boundary condition. So when you go from one red round to another red round, the bug wave function is similar, but then the boundary wave function is different.
Oh, I see, sorry, I misunderstood. You're saying that the time translation symmetry is because going all the way from the left hand to the right hand side, but then then the wave function is saying that E becomes M. Okay, I understand now. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. All right, yeah, so that's all with the introduction. So now I will go to my actual work. So to see whether this EM automorphism is robust up to some microscopic variation, I need to somehow construct shot variation. And the way I do it is that I keep on the red links and blue links perfect, but in the green round, I will randomly erase some bonds here with the probability PM. And then you can see that in two extreme, when PM is zero, then everything is perfect. And as I already showed you, we will have an EM exchange every cycle. But if PM is close to one, which means we completely erase this blue round, this green round, then we only have two rounds per each cycle. And then because here you have E exchange to M every round. So if your cycle only have two rounds, then you have something like E change to M and then M change back to E, which means you see no EM exchange. But then, so the question is, what happened to this EM automorphism when you have PM somewhere between zero and one? So I talk a lot about the EM automorphism. So how do we actually see that? So this is the protocol to see that. First, I will initialize my circuit with the E-type along the X direction, and then another E-type along the Z direction. So these two commit with each other, so it's perfectly legitimate to initialize your system with two operators like this. Then I will evolve my circuit with on the red and blue links being measured. And then for the green links, I will randomly skip some of them with probability PM. And then to see the EM automorphism, I will measure the original XE loop given by this operator. And one thing I would like to notice is that this quantity is not linear in the density matrix, which is one thing you need to actually see some measurement-induced phase. So why does this protocol work? If you look at, let's say, at some even cycle, we have the XE and ZE in the stabilizer group, then if we have the EM automorphism, then to the next cycle, the odd cycle, then XE will change into XM and ZE change into ZM. But because ZM, this one, anti-commit with XE, so if you have ZM in a stabilizer group, the measurement of XE will be zero. And then when you move to the next cycle, then XM change back to XE and ZM change back to ZE. Because so right now we have XE in the stabilizer group. So its measurement will give you a deterministic either plus one or minus one. And when you square it up, then it's just plus one. So with this protocol, when we in the flow case side, you will see a oscillation from plus one, minus one, plus one, minus one. When you go to the other limit at PM equal one, you just see that the oscillation just flicks at plus one. So this is what happened when you are at the true limit of the interpolation. If you're somewhere in the intermediate value, then in the flow case side, when PM is larger than zero, but smaller than some critical value, then you see that the oscillation actually decay. But you can still distinguish two branches, one for the even cycle and one for the odd cycle. On the other side of the interpolation, the non-flow case side, when PM is larger than some critical value and smaller than one, you still see a decaying oscillation, but then you will no longer see the two branches feature here. You only see one branch of the oscillation. So why do we have this decay of the oscillation? The thing is that when I talk about E and M excitation string, there's another type of the string, which I call here the S string. And this S string is the product of all the check along one path. And this fixed point string, I call it the fixed point because you will see that this one commit with all the link measurement. So when the code measure this link, this operator, then this operator will stay in the stabilizer group afterward. And then because this link, I'm sorry, this string, anti-commit with the E string and also the M string. So when these strings are measured, you will not see the E or M excitation in the measurement. So that's why you see here when the oscillation of G decays to zero, then the measure, the expectation value of S raised to almost one, raised to one. So I guess right now you might have the question that because this EM automorphism, it will decay eventually in the thermodynamic limit. So is it still a other parameter here? And my answer is yes, because so this case is only valid in a finite size system. When you go to the infinite size, you actually see that this EM oscillation survive to infinite time. So this is the detail analysis here. So instead of showing the actual oscillation of the EM exchange, I will compute the zero component of that oscillation given by the sum of the odd cycle, of the even cycle and the next odd cycle. And then you can see from all the three figures that this quantity, it can be fit nicely to a exponential function. And then if you look at here on the flow gas side, when PM is small, you see that as I increase system size, the slope also decreases. So it's safe to speculate that in the thermodynamic limit, when L approaches infinity, you have a completely flat function, which is type one here. And the same thing, if you look at the other side, when PM is large, you also see that when I increase system size from here to here, the slope also decreases. And we can guess that in the thermodynamic limit, when L approaches infinity, then we will have a constant function at true here. So this number is actually is true. Yeah.
So can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
So what happens if you mess up with the red measurements as well?
So yeah, I will show you later when we mess up with two colors instead of one.
Okay.
Yeah. So here I do the finite size scaling with G naught, which is with G naught at the zero time, which is just G at time zero plus the G at one. And then you can see a transition from one here at for small PM to true at larger PM. And then when I collapse this data, I can find that I can find the critical value PM to be around 0.65, and then the scaling exponent to be 1.3. And if I do the same thing to the decay rate beta here, we can see that when PM is different from the critical point, then beta decay with the system size. And then when we collapse the data at different system size, you also see, you can also find the critical point to be 65 here, and also the scaling exponent to be also 1.34, which is very close to the 1.32 showing this G naught at zero time. And beside the zero component, I can also compute the pi component of the oscillation, which is the difference between the even cycle and the next odd cycle. I can also fit this function into a exponential decay. And then if you look at the pi component at zero time, now you see a transition from one to zero. And data collapse will show the same critical point here with more or less the same scaling exponent. And you can see also see the same thing for the decay rate beta pi here. So what we learned from this scaling analysis is that in the thermodynamic limit, when L is infinite, then for any P smaller than the critical point PM here, which is 0.65, you will see an oscillation zero from 1 to 0, 1, 0, 1, 0. And that oscillation will extend to infinite time. On the other side, if PM is larger than the critical 0.65 here, then you will see the expectation value of the E string just stay at 1, 1, 1 up to infinite time. So that established that the EM automorphism is actually a immersion behavior that are robust up to some microscopic variation. And if you look at this mu here, the scaling exponent here, the 1.3 is somewhat close to the 4/3 exponent of the 2D population. And right now I will show you that I can actually map this flow cat to non-flow cat transition to a percolation process. And that will explain both the critical point here and the scaling exponent.
Just curious, I mean, this is a
random
question. What if I, is it important to keep the flow cat symmetry? So if the, let's say what I decide to mess up with changes from cycle to cycle a little bit, so the flow cat is no longer a symmetry, does it matter for this purpose?
So I think it, so if you just look at this, the protocol I have here.
Yeah.
So actually, if you just fit with one random configuration, then the actual random configuration here changes from cycle to cycle. Because like for each cycle, I would choose a different random configuration to mess up with the green links here. Per each trajectory, we actually slightly mess up with the time translational symmetry, but on average, we still have that translational symmetry.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So that is, I mean, we do need the time symmetry, but only in the average sense.
I see. Okay, thanks.
Okay, so now, as I promised, I will map this flow cat to non-flow cat transition to a percolation process. So this is the process I already showed you, the microscopic process when we start with an E string. And then when we apply all the blue links measurement and all the green links measurement, it will be converted into an M string. And then you can coarse grain this picture into, let's say, an E string multiply with the string operator like this. So if you multiply this string with this string, you will have this string. So that's why I said this is a coarse grain operator. This is a coarse grain picture. And this is, if you think of it from a high level, it's somewhat similar to, let's say, you fuse an E anion with a psi fermion to get a M anion. So if you look at this path here, then when we have all the blue links, then it's trivial to construct such a path, right? But then let's say if we don't have any blue links, any green links, it's also obvious that we cannot construct any path like this, because if we only have, let's say, the blue and red links, then the best thing we can do is to construct a black hat operators, but we can never have a path like this. So now we can have some kind of intuitive picture is that if we miss too many green links, then it might be impossible to construct such a continuous path like this. So the question is, how many is too many? And we can find the answer in the percolation process. So here, this lattice is just, I simply replot the measurement schedule here. So here on the red links and blue links are measured, which I plot as a solid links here. And then some green links are measured, which I also plot as solid links, but some are missing, which I plot as a the dashed link here. So you can think of it like a population picture where for a link, you can have a probability to turn it on or off. And then you ask the question, at what probability you can construct, you can move a particle from one side to infinity through the link being turned on. So that question is exactly what we have here. Like for what probability of turning on or off the green links can we construct a continuous path? And if you look at this this lattice, and then if you view this red, green, black, red, blue, black at a sign, then you see that we have an effective triangular lattice here. And then for a 2D percolation on triangular lattice, people have shown that the threshold to be around 0.35. But here I'm talking about the missing probability. So we have to subtract it from one, which will give you 0.65 here. And because it's a 2D percolation process, so the scaling exponent is given by 4/3, which is approximately 1.33. And then if you look at this true value, 0.65 and 1.3, you see that they exactly, well, quantitatively match with the value PMC and mu that I extracted from measuring the expectation value of the A string. So at this point, we can map this flow cat to non-flow cat to a percolation process on a triangular lattice. But then there's still a question is that, so you can see at the transition, for example, here, the transition from 1 to 0, the critical point actually matched with the critical point in the decay rate. So whether decay rate is smaller than PM or larger than PM, then the decay rate is always suppressed by system size. So this is another feature that I want to explore. So why does that happen? So if you look at this measurement schedule here, then if we group all the plackets that can be connected to each other by some green links, then we will have some cluster in the system. And then between the cluster, we can draw a a domain wall like this. Now, so if I actually dissect this measurement schedule into three individual rounds, you see that at the blue, we have, let's say we start with all the blue rounds, and then we apply some green measurement on it. So here I sketch out the updating rules here. If for a blacket with all the blue rounds, we measure all the green rounds, or just blue, two of the three green links, then what we have is a plugin with all the blue links being replaced by all the green links. On the other hand, if you just have one green link, if you just measure one green link, then the updated stabilizer group will consist of one blue link here, one green link here, and one open string here. So in this green round, you can see some open string like this. So let me just show you. You have this string, and on the other side, you can see the same thing. You have this string. So at this point, you can see that they are all disconnected segments. But when we move to the next red round, and then so we will have the red links between these segments. So the red links will connect these segments into a string operator like this one. And this one. So the important thing here is that when the Flowcat code evolves, it will measure a string operator along the domain wall. But then, so when you think about it, beside away from the critical point, then you always have a finite length of the domain wall. But then right at the critical point, then you will have a diversion of the domain wall. And that diversion of domain wall will give you the critical damping at the critical, the damping at the critical point, because you know it's diversion, so it cannot be suppressed by system size. So let me conclude. So let me just summarize what we have so far for the Flowcat to non-Flowcat phase transition. So what happens at the critical point? So first, when we tune PM from 0 to 1, then the dominant cluster will cease to exist. And when that starts to happen, then it's impossible to find a continuous side path that will induce the EM exchange. So after that, the critical point PMC here, the EM exchange is no longer observable. Also, in unison with this dominant cluster cease to exist, we also have a diversion of a domain wall. So normally you can describe the typical length of the domain wall by this C, which you can think of it as a correlation length. But then right at the critical point here, C will diverge, which means the probability to measure an exponent, the probability to measure a long string will be constant in system size. And with these two arguments, I can conclude that the critical properties of the Flowcat to non-Flowcat phase transition can actually be mapped to a percolation transition on a triangular lattice. So this is a beautiful picture. We can map it exactly to a classical model and study everything of it. So what happened if we further enrich this process? So here, instead of messing up with one color, now I messed up with two color. So in the limit PM equals 0, we still have the Flowcat code, but in the limit of PM close to 1, then we have exactly the stationary toric code, because here you can think of it like we measure all the red links and then do nothing and then measure all the red links again. So that's just the stationary toric code. And then I can, by using the same protocol that I already showed you to observe the EM exchange, I can show that even in this case, we can still see a phase transition from Flowcat to non-Flowcat phase. So here, the first round is the zero component of the EM oscillation, and the second round is the pi component of the EM oscillation. And when you collapse this one, you can still see that even though we have a different critical point here, but the exponent, the scaling exponent is still the same as about 1.3, which is close to the 2D percolation exponent of Fulton. Yeah, so here, even though we distort the interpolation process a little bit, we still see that it still sit in the same universality class described by 2D percolation.
Sorry, can I ask you a question? I guess I probably missed something. Can I go back to what last slide?
You mean this one?
PM is one, if you're only measuring the red link, why is that a toric code? I thought you mentioned that you basically get 3 qubits on the links, right?
Yeah, so thank you for asking. So this is a little bit, so this plus one, so this one here is a singular limit actually. So what you want is PM to be strictly less than one, so that a few blue links and green links will give you the black hat operators.
I see.
So if you have a collection of red links and all the black hat operator, it will give you the toric code.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thank you for asking. So now I just want to further enrich my phase diagram. So besides just randomly erase a link, I will also randomly just change a 2-qubit measurement to single qubit measurement. So specifically, if my original measurement operator is x1, x2, then I will measure the single qubit operator x1 on one end and x2 on the other hand. So the reason I have this arrow in my model because this will anti-commute with the black gas operator. So if you look back, if I just randomly erase link, then my black gas operators are still stable because it commutes with every link's measurement. But if I introduce this arrow into the model, then even the black gas operator can be destroyed and then maybe later recover. So the dynamic will be definitely richer. So we already know that if we don't have any TE arrow here, then we have a transition from the flow gas sign when PM is less than about 0.48 to a non-flow sign or the stationary torical sign when PM is larger than 0.48. So what happened when we have another dimension of single qubit arrow? So now I want to take a slight digression and look at a different quantity. So the thing I'm looking at here is a tripartite entanglement entropy computed by this equation. So we will partition the torus into four parts with the length L divided by four for each part. And then we compute the tripartite entanglement entropy by this formula. So the tripartite entanglement entropy has a nice property that if you are in the topological phase, then this number will give you plus one. If you are in the area phase, area law phase, it will give you zero. And if you're in the volume law phase, it will give you something like minus L square. So it's a diversion, negative diversion number there. So here I compute the tripartite entanglement entropy for in a two-dimensional parametric phase diagram. And then you can see that if you look at the F3 here, you can see we have two topological blocks here characterized by F3 equal to one. So one here and one here. We also have a volume law here. And then when PM is so large, then we obviously should have the area law phase. But then we already know that when P equals zero, then we know that this size is the flow gas topological size, and this size is the stationary torical size. So my question is that whether we still have the flow gas behavior at some finite value of single qubit arrow PE. So this question is somewhat, so the result might be somewhat disappointing at first. So let me show you what I have. So here I have PM equal 0.4, which is in the flow gas sign. But then I also have some non-zero PE here, which is the probability of single qubit error. So you can see that if I plot the EM oscillation, it will undergo a fast relaxation in the beginning, and then later on it will stabilize at some finite value. And the same thing here when you increase the PE probability. But then the problem is that the stabilized value after the fast relaxation here, it is suppressed with system size, as you can see on this plot. So let's say you just fix one PE, let's say this column. Then when you increase system size, then the amplitude of the EM oscillation actually decreases with system size. So one can think that in the thermodynamic limit when L approaches infinity, then we should not see any EM exchange. So does that mean that we don't have any flow gas behavior when we have this, when we have non-zero single qubit error? So my guess is that we still have the flow gap property with single qubit arrow. It's just that the way we observe it is not optimal. So let me just explain it. Here we have some single qubit arrow here. And the string I want to measure is this E string along the X direction. But then this string might accidentally cross an arrow, which means its expectation value will become zero. And because this E string is an extended object, so in the thermodynamic limit, the length of the E string is also infinity, which means that it's always guaranteed for the E string to cross some arrow. So that's why we see a decay of the EM oscillation with system size. So an obvious fix to this problem is that every time we want to measure the EM oscillation, we can just choose some E prime string that doesn't cross any arrow like this one. And this is my result. So the blue lines are the measurement taken by just measuring the string that I initialized to the system. And then the yellow lines are the result when I measure on the corrected string. And then you can see that when PM is 0.2, which is pretty far away from the critical point, then this correction scheme can almost recover the EM exchange. So specifically, you can see here that without any correction, then the stable value is around 0.6. But when I correct the string here, which is given by this E prime string here, then I can recover this the amplitude almost up to plus one. And then this is the result when I have with systems with different system size. But then as I move closer to a critical point, then this correcting scheme is less and less effective, as you can see here. So the correction still somewhat improve the EM oscillation, but you can see here the improvement is not that much, and then you can still see a visible decay with system size. So is it really hopeless? So my answer is that maybe this correction scheme is just too naive for our model. So the thing is that if you look at this phase diagram here, and as I already mentioned, the flowcat code will also measure string operator. And then without any operator, without any arrow, the only string operator that can be allowed by stabilizer group are loop operators. And for loop operator, you can always string it to a blockhead operator, as long as it doesn't wrap around the torus. But then when you have some finite single qubit arrow in your system, then it's possible to have a loop connecting between this arrow. But then away from the critical point, then we know that the length of this loop should be very short. So the only way it can happen is that the loop just connect one arrow back to itself. But then you see that this tap arrow is trivial because again, we can always string this loop to only a plug-in operator. And then by just avoiding the single qubit arrow, then I can also avoid this string arrow. But when we go closer to the critical point, then the flowcat code start to measure longer and longer string. And then we can have a situation where we have string arrows connecting these two single qubit arrows. And then let's say if I just simply update my string to avoid single qubit arrow, then there's still a probability for that string to cross this string arrow. And that will give you, and that explains why the performance of this scheme actually degrade as you go closer to the critical point. So what is the better way to see the flowcat behavior when you have single qubit arrow? So this is actually an open question. A better way, I think, is that we should construct a flowcat topological invariant. So let me just give you some insight from band topology. For static 2D, the topological invariant is the common Chern number, which is computed in a two-dimensional case space. And when you go to the flowcat case, then you also have an extension along with time. So now your topological environment is actually a winding number in a 3D space, comprised of two spatial dimension and one temporal dimension. So, and now we move to the sign of topological order. So for the static case, you can always detect the topological order by, for example, computing the topological entanglement entropy. And this number will be robust by some up to some perturbation of either the Hamiltonian or the way you draw the partition. So is it a same thing? So my question is that can we construct the same topological invariant for this flow cap topological order as I already showed you? So right now I don't have any clear answer for this question yet, but then what we have to look at is something that not just look at one snapshot of the wave function, but at both the three snapshot. Let's say this is the wave function after the red round. And then we also need to look at the wave function after the blue round and the green round. And then we must construct a way to connect these three wave function together to interpolate whether we are in the flow cap phase or in the non-flow cap phase. So yeah, this is an open question that I'm super excited to explore. And with that, I want to conclude my talk and thank you for your attention.
All right, thanks, Dewey. Any more questions?
So normally when we measure with string operators, you kind of distinguish between area law expectation value and volume law expectation value, right? And like we view area law decay as being a signature still of deconfinement.
Please.
So in the numerics results that you gave, is it area law decay or perimeter law decay?
When I actually look at this one with system size, you see that the signal actually decay with an area law with system size here. So this is a log linear scale. So that's why I still believe that we are still in the flow cap phase, not in the non-flow cap phase.
Would be the perimeter law decay that would be deconfinement, right?
Yeah, but here we are in a two-dimensional system, right? So the parameter is actually a proportional to the linear size, which is L.
Yeah, so is the decay e to the minus L or something?
Yes. Yes, yeah, yes.
Yeah, okay.
So that's why the reason I still believe that we should have we should be able to see the flow cap behavior even in a finite area, even if we have finite error rate.
Right.
I mean, maybe I'm a little bit confused. So
okay. Yes.
If I take a normal gauge theory, if I allow matter field to come in, I will get perimeter law anyway, right? So here by allowing the single qubit error, in a toric code analogy, you're allowing the E or M particle excitations, right? So in this case, is area law versus perimeter law still a good indication of deconfinement?
Seeing it, let's see. Oh yes, it is, yeah. Yeah, so in the area law you have, let me show you. So in the area law, you still have some string operator here, which you can think of it as annual excitation.
Mm-hmm.
But because the string operator, they are finite in system size. They are finite in length. So you can think of it as a confined anneal. But then when you move up to the volume law, you see string that are extensive in the system size. So in that case, you will have a deconfined phase.
Any other question?
Yeah, so I have one question. So suppose we soften the projection instead of doing the hard projection to the two qubit subspace. To allow some small but non-zero probability outside that two-dimensional local Hilbert space for say x, y, z for these three colors of projection. Wouldn't it be more like finite temperature that will destroy the topological order completely? Or do you think this will still survive?
So actually I don't have a concrete answer on top of my head right now. So this case is a strong projective measurement. What you're saying is probably a weak measurement, which I guess we can think of it like some decoherence on top of this model. Yeah, so I think it's equivalent to have a finite temperature or let's say a noisy environment, and it. And it's also, I think you're correct. It's very likely that it will destroy the topological order in the long time limit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I do believe that, you know, like if we look at a short time window, we should still be able to see the EM automorphism here.
Mm-hmm. So when we say it's robust, probably we have to constrain the type of measurement we are doing here. Within that class, it is a robust behavior. Is there some sharp?
Yeah, so I see. So I think the constraint here is probably the measurement should be projective measurement.
Uh-huh.
And then also like there's a more obvious constraint is that the amplitude of the noise should be small enough, as you can see from this phase diagram.
Mm-hmm. I mean, as far as there's a finite region, that I think that's we can regard it as robust.
But... Yeah, yes, that's true.
Maybe higher dimensional topological order might be more robust against such incomplete projection. Maybe.
But I think, you know, like, let's say if you look at the, you don't have any, you don't do any measurement, you just do some unitary evolution to your qubit, then I think eventually the qubit will be the quantum circuit will be thermalized. So I think no matter what dimension you're working on, if you have some finite temperature and then your circuit is somewhat non-integrable, then they will all share the same ultimate phase of thermalization, and then we should not see anything interesting at that point. Yeah, and one remark that I would like to make is that I think up to this point, I am not aware of any unitary model that can realize the flow cap topological order. So usually because in a solid system in a unitary evolution, if your system is slightly non-integrable, then eventually it will be heated to infinite temperature and then it will become completely featureless.
Mm-hmm.
But then in this model, we can see that the EM exchange is actually manifest quite naturally without, you know, like forcing some MBL to the system. Mm-hmm. So I think it's also one beautiful features of this model.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Fast.
All right, thanks. Any other question? Yeah, if no, let's thank Dewey again. Yeah, thanks, Dewey. Nice talk.
Yeah, it's my honor to give a presentation here.